On this week's 51%, we speak with the Vice President of the New York Legal Assistance Group about the importance of providing sound and trauma-informed legal advice to survivors of domestic violence and what people should know if they bring their abuser to court.
Your own story, your own words, your own testimony can be enough.
We also stop by an art exhibit showcasing the work of incarcerated women. I'm Jesse King. It's all up next on 51%.
I was standing around like one of those girls I had seen in a movie. The whole world was a movie back then. I had my sunglasses on, I wanted to be seen without seeing Shiloh or Lita. I wasn't really in it, I didn't really get it.
You're listening to 51%, a WAMC production dedicated to women's issues and experiences. Thanks for joining us. I'm Jesse King. Escaping a toxic or abusive relationship is not easy. Abuse is about power and control, so there are a lot of reasons why getting away is difficult and dangerous, and staying away can be even harder. In fact, many groups that advocate for survivors of domestic violence say the average survivor will return to their abusive partner 7 times before they leave for good. When they do leave, that's a particularly dangerous time, and they may want to seek legal protection or relief from a court or avoid the legal system altogether. Our main guest today helps survivors figure out their next steps no matter where they're at and what their next goals are. Shawnee Adess is the vice president of the New York Legal Assistance Group, an organization that has been providing free civil legal services and other programs since 1990. NYLAG, as it's called, can offer civil legal advice on a range of issues, from immigration issues to workplace discrimination, but their domestic violence unit focuses specifically on survivors of abuse. Adess says their team worked with 3,400 people in and around New York City last year. Now, laws on divorce, custody, and domestic violence vary from state to state, but I recently spoke with Adess to get some general tips for survivors. Just a heads up to our listeners that this conversation obviously discusses domestic violence. If you or someone you love has been impacted, please know that help is available. The National Domestic Violence Hotline is open 24/7 at 1-800-799-SAFE. You can also reach it by texting START to 88788 or by going online to thehotline.org.
So the Domestic Violence Law Unit at NYLAG is a team of about 20 people who include attorneys, paralegals, as well as long-term volunteers who have been with us for a couple of years. We work with survivors across New York State, though primarily the litigation that we're doing is in courts within New York City, all 5 boroughs. We aim to provide trauma-informed, client-centered services. So what that means is that we think it's incredibly important that when a survivor is finally able to connect with somebody, because we know how many obstacles there are for somebody to actually like access help, that they're able to tell their story, what's happened to them, and what relief they need to one person. That they're building that trust with one person, and that person can respond to the different intersecting needs that they may have in order to help them achieve whatever goals they have and the safety that they're looking for. So we provide family law services. We support people with custody, visitation, support, paternity proceedings, on occasion abuse and neglect proceedings, when there's violence that's being perpetrated by the other parent in the home. We represent people in divorces, both contested and uncontested. We help people with orders of protection. And the same attorney also works with any survivor who's engaging with us on domestic violence-based immigration cases. So if somebody might be eligible for a pathway through VAWA, for example, to obtain their pathway to permanency and stability independently from the partner that was causing them harm, we help them with that process and even have 2 attorneys that have expertise with removal defense for folks who are in immigration court. We do not predicate our services at all on somebody having a case in court or even being wanting to engage with the system. We really make sure that our services are focused on any survivor who wants to just safety plan with us, understand what their rights are, understand what the process would be. And we often are working with folks for months or years before they might even have a case in certain circumstances. And it really is kind of designed, the services that we're going to provide are going to be designed by the survivor who's coming to us.
You mentioned survivors can come across a lot of obstacles before even getting to you guys, before even filing anything in court. What are some of the things that you see people experiencing?
Bigger picture, what we know, what the research is clear about, is that the time in which a survivor is most at risk for lethal intimate partner violence is when they decide to leave and when they leave. We know that the risk of lethal intimate partner violence, unfortunately, vastly escalates for about that 4 month period of time, even post separation and fleeing. So I just want to start there because I think so often people ask the question, why doesn't somebody leave? And I think that one of the important barriers to remember is their actual safety. These are individuals who are thinking about themselves and their kids and trying to determine when and what would be the safest thing for me to do, and recognizing that leaving is sometimes a moment of that escalation, especially if you're going to face other barriers to getting the support to be able to achieve the stability that they might be looking for. Additional barriers that exist is finding stable housing where they can live safely with themselves and their kids. Access to things like diapers, formula. I've worked with survivors in the past who fled and fortunately were able to gain access to a shelter. But their child, they had one child at the time who was an infant, and the child got sick and they needed to buy formula, they needed to buy diapers. And they were all of a sudden navigating what it is to be a parent as a single parent while experiencing trauma, while having to re-sign up for all the benefits that they were previously receiving, to have everything be disconnected from the person who was causing them harm's name. And there's so many things that need to be done, and really making sure that somebody has support and help in navigating processes that are there to help people, but themselves are extraordinarily complex and difficult to understand. Which brings me to just two other barriers that I'll name, though there are many. One is just language access and making sure that all of the things that a survivor might need to access, they can understand and hear about in the language that they speak. And the second is our systems themselves. I think that our systems are structured in such a way that they are, by their very nature, not individualized to every single person that might come to seek help from that system. And what that means for a survivor specifically is that when they're coming in order to seek safety and help, they may talk about the thing that they most need, but are the courts, are the personnel, or the police, whoever it is that they want to engage with, are they giving them the space and time and asking them the questions that could give them that pathway to re legal relief and explain other options they may not know they have? And so I would just say that, like, our systems are built such that really it's so important that people have access to information, knowledge, and like supportive services to help them navigate that.
Well, on that front, to, help get information out there, I know you guys focus on laws in New York, but what should survivors know about their rights and their options? I guess just like statewide and nationwide.
When you go to court, if you're going to ask for an order of protection, if you're going to ask for custody, if you're asking for a divorce, if you're asking the police to start a case against them, all of that is going to differ state to state, what the actual laws are. And then what the actual practice is and what the process is going to even differ within that by locality. And so that is one challenge that people face. The federal law that's kind of really around this, one of the primary federal laws that protects survivors is VAWA, the Violence Against Women Act, that provides so much to support survivors nationwide. It provides funding for essential services, including shelters, for example. It provides funding for social service programs, counseling services, legal services for survivors. It also includes legal forms of relief through the immigration system, so that survivors, for example, under VAWA, survivors who might be married to somebody who's causing them harm and who perhaps are using the fact that the survivor is depending on them for immigration status as a form of coercion, intimidation, and harassment, someone can self-petition through VAWA on their own behalf. There's also other forms of relief like U visas or T visas for survivors who have experienced trafficking by the person who's causing them harm, and survivors who may have reported the crime and cooperated in that. But in terms of what forms of relief exist for folks who are living in New York, I can speak a little bit more about that and what we're seeing at NYLAG. So in New York, survivors have a right to ask the courts for orders of protection. They can go through the civil court process as well as attempt to access the criminal court process if they wish. For the criminal court process, that would be going through the police and the district attorney. For the civil court process, it would be themselves going to either family court or Supreme Court here in New York City in order to file for an order of protection. One thing that's really important, I think, for survivors to know is that you can do both things or either things or no things. And I think that that's something that's really important. Some people may not feel safe engaging with police or going through the criminal court process. They may fear some unintended consequences that could happen to them or even the partner that's causing them harm because of some of the things that are happening within the immigration landscape right now or longstanding community harm that some folks have experienced. But we also have some clients who are afraid to show up in civil court every single day. They're afraid that if they bring that case, it's now their case. And so they have to show up at court appearances. That gives an opportunity to be intimidated, to be harassed, to unfortunately perhaps be stalked or followed outside of the courthouse too, especially if you found a new safe place to live the other person doesn't know. So there may be survivors that prefer to not have that method ongoing. Often we work with people that sometimes might be interested in starting both at NYLAG, and we certainly help people navigate that as well as continue to give them advice and help them if, in the future if they want to change what options they're pursuing, do that.
I have to imagine that some people may worry that leaving or divorcing or even reporting domestic violence could, you know, flag offices like CPS or interfere with their ability to keep custody of their children. I guess what should survivors know on that front?
Yeah, so there was a really important landmark case called Nicholson in New York, New York City, which is really provides support for survivors of domestic violence by saying that ACS, the Administration for Children's Services, they're the agency tasked with investigating abuse and neglect of children, saying that they shouldn't be removing children from a home wherein they believe there's domestic violence unless they've first intervened and provided access to resources and supportive services to survivors. And really what this is, like the crux of this is that a child should not be taken from a survivor just because that survivor is experiencing harm at the hands of another parent. That was really such an essential case in terms of protecting survivors as well as their children in the midst of experiencing the trauma of not only the violence in the home, but the trauma of moving through what it means to now have systems engaging in the home, that separation, that working towards reclaiming the stability and the safety that they're doing as they find new houses, perhaps switch schools, and things of that nature for their kids. I think that one thing that's really important whenever we work with survivors is really making sure that we're clear about how many options there are of people that they should be talking to. I view the crux of working with survivors, and I know at NYLAG, when we're focused on what does it mean to be trauma, doing trauma-informed work for survivors, our goal is to give options. Our goals are not to set forth a path. One of those options that I think is so important for folks to understand is that they can not only talk to us, but they can reach out to a shelter hotline. Just understand, know what it is that's out there. They can talk to a counselor, they can talk to a case manager. I bring all of this up because one thing that I would say to people that often happens is that sometimes folks don't think to talk to a lawyer until there's a legal case or until they're ready to go to court. I think that it can be so important to talk to a lawyer before you're ready to do any of those things necessarily so that you get information and knowledge. And one thing that differs from us versus others is that we're not mandatory reporters. So somebody can come to us and explain what's happening in the home, and we can give them an individualized safety plan, working with them to create it together from the ground up while they're getting all of the other services and support from other folks who are there to make sure that the kids are safe too, right? We're there though for the survivor and the family kind of as a whole and able to build that with them together, whatever safety plan is best for them and their kids.
I'm very glad that you brought up safety planning because, you know, as you said, that this can be a really dangerous time for survivors. I guess I'm wondering, how do you safety plan and what should you be considering when you put a safety plan together?
I think the first thing is, what does a survivor want? As I said, you know, at NYLAG, it's really important to us to never presume that somebody's, I'm ready to flee, I'm ready to separate, I want to move. Those things, I'm ready to file a case in court. So we create the safety plan about what it is that the client's saying their goals are now. and what it is that they might want in the future that we just give them options for. Like, if you want to leave your options open, these are other things to consider. We always talk about physical safety first. But one thing that we keep in mind with a survivor is again, every single person's different. Where do they live? What options do they have? What's in their neighborhood that's open 24 hours a day? Do they have resources, family support, friend support? If not, let's talk about bodegas. Let's talk about libraries. Let's talk about other places that might be safe for somebody to go to. We work with some folks at NYLAG who, may be able to pack a safety bag and a go bag and store that safely at their job where the person can't access it, or a place in the home where the person might not find it. Other people might not be able to. And so we work with them to kind of have in their own mind, what would their safety plan be? Where would they go? What are the things they're grabbing if they need to? Sometimes we have folks send us copies of their passport, their kids' health insurance cards, copies of prescriptions, and we can store that for folks if they may want that for the future. And we also really have to keep in mind now, in particular, I say now, it's been a couple of years, but technology and how much that has expanded, right? If you're going to email stuff to somebody, are you deleting that email? What if that person has access to your tech and things are going to the cloud? Do you need to create a new email address that isn't on any of your devices at home? And just kind of making sure that those kind of like new ways that people can unfortunately use tech to further harm or track survivors, that that's being accounted for too.
We're speaking with Shani Adess, the vice president of the New York Legal Assistance Group. I know you guys deal with such a wide range of cases, but outside safety, are there common things that survivors should be keeping in mind as they navigate working with you or navigate going through the court system?
I think that one thing for a survivor to keep in mind is it's so important to talk to an advocate, if possible, when you're filing a case in court, because sometimes those temporary orders are what it can be so pivotal in ensuring that a survivor is able to take the step that they're trying to take to achieve their stability and reclaim their lives. So, for example, if you're filing for an order of protection, what are the things that you need to include to get the type of order of protection, the level of order of protection that you're actually looking for? And also, the law in New York City allows you to ask for anything that would reasonably further the safety of the survivor who's filing and achieve the aims of the Family Court Act, which means that actually a temporary order of protection can have really individualized pieces that reflect the survivor or their children's needs and lives. Similarly, you can ask for a temporary order of support, for example, child support on an order of protection if there's no child support order that's already in place. That can be so imperative for somebody if they, need to buy those diapers, if they need to buy those formula, if they need to buy food, to know that and to also be able to include in the initial petition what it is that would help them form that, get that piece of relief. And so I think talking to advocates is really, really important. The other thing that I just think is really important for folks to know and to understand is that court takes a long time. Our courts in New York City are protracted. Most cases are not going to be resolved quickly. Our cases at NYLAG, we see that we work with clients once we're in court for, if it's for one type of case, maybe it's 8 months to a year. We can be working with people in court for 2, 3, 4 years, especially if it's like a divorce, for example, or a particularly contested case. We know that sometimes the people who cause harm use leverage the court system to try to continue to perpetuate harm, carry through on threats, make somebody feel harassed and intimidated, unfortunately, as they're going through that process. So just knowing in advance that this is a long process, not everything is going to happen that first day and that second day or that third day, I think can be really important because of course it can be re-traumatizing and really anxiety producing and stressful every time that you're going into court, especially if you're thinking, oh, it's going to be resolved today. Oh, I'm going to have to testify today or present evidence. And so understanding that that court process is long, I think can be really important for folks in advance.
I guess this might be a bit of a side question, but I didn't know that there were different types of protection orders, at least in New York. So I guess I'm wondering, like, what are the different types of protections and how do they work?
So there are different types of orders of protection here in New York that you can request. You can request civil orders of protection again from the Family Court and the Supreme Court. I'm going to use the colloquial terms and then define what those means. You can ask for a limited order of protection. A limited order of protection means do not, and then it lists the offenses that the family court would hear if somebody did in fact commit that would form the basis of an order of protection. So do not harass, do not assault, etc., this person. And limited order of protections can be really important for survivors. Sometimes when a survivor is living with somebody and they're not yet ready to leave, or sometimes when a survivor still wants to be able to have communication for whatever reason with that person, maybe they have things to coordinate, maybe they have children and they still want to be able to text and have those phone calls. A limited order of protection can enable actual contact to still happen. But what it is providing the survivor is with there is an order that says, do not harass, assault, etc., this person. And if you do, under New York law right now, violate an order of protection, you'd be subject to mandatory arrest if somebody were to report that to a police. And it certainly could also, even through the civil court system, form a basis for asking to expand the order of protection or file a violation there. Generally,
Okay.
when people are thinking about an order of protection, they're thinking about a stay away order of protection. So a stay away order of protection means just that, stay away from this person, their home, their work. You can fill in all of those places, for example. That's how you can individualize it. It can mean no contact by phone. You can individualize it to mean no contact by Facebook, no contact by Instagram, where we're seeing some of those like specific threats happening. We sometimes name that explicitly in the request for the order of protection to make sure it's clear to everybody what this means. And then the final type of order of protection that you can ask for in New York is called an exclusion order. And that is only for two people that are already living together, where you're asking to exclude the other party from the home. And so you don't need an exclusion order if you don't live together. A stay away order is going to ensure the protective level of that person not coming to your house. But if you live in the same house and you're asking that other person to be removed from the house for your safety, that would be requesting an exclusion order of protection.
Lastly, obviously the testimony you provide in these cases is evidence, but you mentioned that people will sometimes leave documents and files with you before even thinking about filing a legal proceeding. I guess what kinds of records do you recommend survivors keep just in case they decide to go to court?
Before I answer this question, I'm just going to say so that survivors don't fear another obstacle or barrier to coming to court, there is no evidence that is absolutely required in order to ask for an order of protection. Your own story, your own words, your own testimony can be enough. And I don't want people to think you need actual documentary evidence before you can actually seek that relief. But if there is documentary evidence, like you received a threat, and you got it by text, or if somebody's calling you. I've here at NYLAG, I previously worked with a client who received 50 calls in one day, 20 calls the next day, 100 calls the following day. Screenshotting those call logs, screenshotting those texts, and saving that can be really important. Not just saving it on your phone, because first of all, that might not be safe. Also, you can lose your device. But figuring out who could be a safe person to send those to, again, creating perhaps a new email address when not tied to your cloud, sending them to a friend that you might trust, or a service provider, somebody like NYLAG or any of our city's family justice centers have case managers, social service providers who would all kind of do, work with survivors to kind of help maintain documents for their future. I think it's really important for survivors, if you have a medical condition or your kids do, copies of those prescriptions, doctors' names and numbers. If you're fleeing and you're running out with just all you have on you in that moment, you might need that stuff quickly for the next day. Copies of insurance cards. For survivors who maybe aren't fleeing just yet, and maybe they're married, or maybe they're depending on the other person for immigration status, taking copies of pictures of immigration notices so that you also have a copy of what that case number is. If you ever see that immigration notice and they can't take that from you to try to impede you from following through on your own case, I think can be really important. That's where I'll stop for now.
Well, Shawnee, thanks so much for taking the time. Is there anything else that you'd like our listeners to know?
The only thing that I want to say is that every survivor has lived with the experience of the coercion, the threats, and the harm, and has lived for a long time creating their own safety plan for themselves about how to keep themselves and their kids safe in the moment. And we all should trust them in determining what it is that is safest for them and when. And our role should always be to expand options. So, for folks who may know somebody who's experiencing domestic violence or has had a friend or a family member in that position, not judging somebody, not limiting avenues to access by saying, you should leave this person and I'm annoyed, I'm done with hearing about this, I'm not going to keep talking to you. The most important thing that we can do, because what a person who's causing harm in the context of domestic violence is doing is they're exerting, using coercion to have power and control over another person to make their words world smaller so that they have that power and control. The best thing that we can do is to make people's worlds bigger. So whenever they're ready, they can engage with us, and that we should, as individuals, as a community, as the systems that survivors are engaging with, trust survivors when they come forward and make ourselves as accessible as possible to them so that they don't face another barrier that could impede their ability to reclaim their lives as they're trying to.
Shani Adess is the vice president of the New York Legal Assistance Group, which provides free civil legal services and advocates for those impacted by economic, racial, and social injustice. You can learn more about their work at NYLAG.org. And obviously, if you or someone you love has been impacted by domestic violence, please know help is available. There are groups like NYLAG, but also the National Domestic Violence Hotline is available 24/7 at 1-800-799-SAFE and at thehotline.org. Again, that's 1-800-799-SAFE and thehotline.org. Shani, thanks again.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
In New York's Hudson Valley, a new art exhibit showcases the work of incarcerated women at the Ulster County Correctional Facility. As WAMC's news intern Samantha Stolbaum reports, the exhibit gives women an avenue to tell their own stories.
So I'm Marilena Ferrer-Harrington. I'm the executive director of UNISON.
For the past year, Mary Elena Ferrer-Harrington has worked with incarcerated women at the Ulster County Jail in a pilot art program. What started as a way to give inmates a creative outlet, funded by an $8,000 grant from Arts Mid-Hudson, is now on view at Unison Arts in New Paltz in a new exhibit called Voices Unbound.
We want them to be comfortable working with images and with the language of visual art so that they can understand and also think about composition, think about how to use different symbols or elements that, you know, that can put forward whatever message or story they would like to tell.
Each week, Ferrer-Harrington set up stations at white folding tables to help inmates explore their stories. Supplies were somewhat limited, colored pencils, erasers, magazine photos, and safety scissors. But with prompts suggesting the women create storyboards, self-portraits, or collages, the results were abundant. When asked about her favorite piece, Ferrer-Harrington points to a 16-frame storyboard.
Is a story of migration and how after month and month and month crossing through the infamous Darien Gap and being arrested at the border and having gone through a lot of hardship, she found herself arrested. But also we have here her dreams. They are in Spanish because she's learning English. One of her dreams is to continue taking classes of English and to be back with her children and her family and to know Miami and to, you know, to enjoy things that life has to offer.
All of the artists in Voices Unbound are anonymous, and that's partly due to the nature of working in a jail. Sometimes participants will only be there for a few days, while others could be there for weeks. But being anonymous allowed participants to tell stories they might not otherwise publicly share. A similar freedom is on display in Eyewitness, an exhibit alongside Voices Unbound. It's by New Paltz's Tona Wilson, a painter and book artist who spent years working as a Spanish interpreter within the court system, primarily in immigration. Due to the nature of her work, she was often unable to share details, but creating art provided her the right outlet to process what she's seen.
I'm not great as a portraitist, which is good. So it really is. Like, I'm not good at,
so
like, getting, but gestures I can get. And I figure a gesture, you know, anybody could have that gesture.
Most of Wilson's work consists of glass paintings inspired by her sketchbook drawings, with photos of her sketches next to the finished piece. She also has two books on display. One interactive book showcases the different uniforms you might see in a courthouse. Visitors can mix and match black robes of judges, stilettos worn by lawyers, and the jumpsuits worn by inmates. One painting depicts a case that was particularly upsetting for Wilson. It shows an immigrant being led out of the courtroom in handcuffs by a man in a suit, while two officers stand by. Wilson says the man had been in court for a separate case, not for an immigration hearing.
I was sitting next to the defendant day after day after day after day, and, you know, you translate for them all through the trial. And he was talking about how he was, when he got out, he was going to become a citizen because he really wanted to vote. And when the verdict was going to come in, he was praying. But at the end of the trial, he was declared not guilty. And he was so happy. And his brother was coming to pick him up. We were heading outside of the courtroom, and there was this guy in the hallway, and he said, "I'm from immigration." At that time, it wasn't ICE, and took him into custody on a prior. He had a prior, probably, you know, like shoplifting or something, charge. And I mean, he was so happy 1 minute, and then boom.
Wilson says the piece has new resonance amid the Trump administration's deportation strategies. Still, the goal of both exhibits is to present the work and the stories behind it without judgment. The Ulster County program was also meant to simply give the women something fun to do. In one prompt, inmates worked together to draw a character without knowing what their partners were drawing, ending in a big reveal.
It was like magic for them when we open and they start laughing and then thinking of crazy stuff. And then they started telling stories about these creatures.
Farrah Harrington says she hopes to get another grant to keep the project going. She also wants to be able to follow up with women who have been released.
It's been like really, really very, I don't know how to say, rewarding. Yeah. It's tough, but at the same time, it's very rewarding to see those small differences. You know, when you see in their eyes, they laugh. Sometimes they get too loud. Sometimes they are very, very, you know, beaten up. And, you know, it's hard to really try to raise, you know, a little bit the mood, but they always do something.
The exhibit is on view at Unison Arts through August 2nd. Reporting from New Falls for WAMC, I'm Samantha Stolbaum.
Thanks for listening to this week's 51%. 51% is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio based in Albany, New York. It's produced and hosted by me, Jesse King. Our associate producer is Madeline Reynolds, and our theme is Lolita by the Albany-based artist Girl Blue. Just a reminder that you can listen to 51% anytime at wamcpodcast.org or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can stay in the loop on all of WAMC's shows by signing up for our weekly newsletter, Airwaves, at wamc.org. We hope you'll join us next week. Until then, I'm Jesse King, 51%.
I was every single girl, I was nobody else, I was so sure of myself. I was 15 and a half, he was a hollow laugh. And I lost my cool somewhere along the way. At night and down the hallway, I had to learn how to look away. I lost my cool. Said everything I do, I feel fine.